Feeney.
I'm Clancy.
And I'm Damien.
Now you might be asking, what do two Aussies and a Pom have in common?
Quite a lot, actually.
For starters, Her Majesty has her face on all our currencies.
Even the coins.
There's a great Union Jack floating around some flags as well.
And we speak the same language, sort of.
Somehow.
Allegedly.
And we love winding each other up.
What are we doing here then?
Winding you up. But anyway, on this show, we discuss current Australian politics.
We take a look at past events.
While on a mission to ensure the Governor General stays in their job.
What? I didn't sign up for this. What?
It's in the show's name, Phoebe. Welcome to Let's Save the Governor General.
No, I don't want to. Kick him out.
What about her?
Or her. No, let's just not have a Governor General. Let's have a republic.
With who is president?
Not ScoMo.
President ScoMo. President ScoMo.
No, President Julia Gillard.
President Craig Kelly.
Welcome, Rodney Croom, to Let's Save the Governor General. And we're going to have a chat with Rodney today, as he is probably the most important figures in Tasmania, particularly in Australia as a whole, regarding the decriminalisation of homosexuality in Tasmania. I think it was 1997. Is that right, Rodney?
Yes, that's right. Thanks very much for having me on the podcast. It's wonderful to be asked to talk about these important historical events.
Very pleased to have you here. And also, of course, it's recently been the anniversary of the equal marriage debate and the event subsequent to that, which I know that you were very active within and an important part of. So we're going to touch on that as well. So tell me a little bit about yourself and how you actually got into activism about this particular issue.
I wasn't naturally an activist. I grew up on a dairy farm in northwest Tasmania and moved to Hobart when I was 17 to study history. And I came from a background where activism, it was not sort of part of the cultural furniture at all. Like I said, farmers for many generations. But I knew when I went to Hobart that I was gay. And in Hobart, as I came out, I learned more and more about how oppressive the laws and attitudes were in Tasmania back then. And something inside me clicked. I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to work with others to change that. When I first went to gay community meeting in Hobart, it was the end of 1987, and I was asked by the people running the meeting not to ask other people there what their surnames were and not to give them my surname in case there were police informers. And I was told that when I left the meeting and went to my car, there could be police there writing down the registration numbers of me and other people leaving the meeting to add to a so-called pink list of known homosexuals. I'd grown up thinking that I lived in a democracy, but when I came out as a gay man in Tasmania in 1987, I realised very quickly that I lived in a police state. At that stage in Tasmania, the penalty for two men having a sexual relationship was a maximum of 21 years in jail. It was the most draconian penalty in the Western world for being gay. And men had been arrested for being gay in Tasmania up until the early 80s. So it was only a few years before I came out that those laws were still being enforced.
What was the sort of prosecution level? Like, how many of those men who were arrested were incarcerated? Was that a known thing?
I know from speaking to historians in Sydney who have looked at this that Tasmania had a very high incarceration rate or arrest and prosecution and incarceration rate, higher than the other states. And I have met men who were incarcerated, who were sent to Risdon prison in the 1950s and 60s. So as a gay man coming out in the 1980s, there was this terrible legacy of police repression and prejudice hanging over our heads, hanging over my head as a young gay man. And I knew that a lot of young gay people simply left Tasmania because of that deadly legacy. And I guess I was very unwilling to do that. And that there were other people I knew at the time I met in the late 80s at university who felt the same. We weren't going to be turned into sexual refugees. We weren't going to be forced to leave Tasmania. Tasmania was the place that had shaped who we were. And we were going to stay here and change that law. If we leave, we'll never be free. That was the slogan we had, that we could only be free in the place that shaped who we were. Hobart was a melting pot of different ideas at that stage, because this is the late 80s. The Green Movement was very strong. Of course, the women's movement was very strong, Aboriginal movement as well. And there was a very strong sense of place and Tasmanian identity, belief that it was possible to challenge traditional notions of what it meant to be Tasmanian. And in our case, the traditional notion was that what it meant to be Tasmanian was that you were straight. As the slogan of the other side, those who supported the law said at the time, we're all straight, over Bass Strait. Well, we weren't. And we were going to show that we weren't. We were going to change those laws. But of course, it was a real struggle.
So how much influence did movements in other parts of Australia have on you? Because just as an example, I mean, I grew up in Sydney during the 80s. You know, I was in my teenage years and I took great pleasure in being at the Mardi Gras in Oxford Street when I was 15, 16 years old. And that was actually almost an iconic part of my coming of age, being there. And it was almost unbelievable to me that my friends that I went to school with, that I was so close with, if they lived in Tasmania, they could have been put in jail. And there was, I mean, there was a real coming of age thing in Sydney at that time as well about that stuff. So how much would that have influenced you?
I'm going to be honest with you, not much. Everyone knew about the Mardi Gras, and that was a thing, right? But for us, the struggle was to be queer and to be Tasmanian and to reconcile those identities, to bring them together and to be proud of both. So it was the movements in Tasmania that were bubbling along at that stage. They were the ones that were important to us. The Green Movement had showed that Tasmania can change for the better. The Aboriginal Movement had shown that you could change what it meant to have a Tasmanian identity. It didn't have to be all one thing, in their case, white. The Women's Movement showed that possible to get large numbers of people on side. We took our inspiration from local movements. The reason I'm so definite about this is that while there were definitely people in Sydney and Melbourne who were allies and supporters of our push for change in Tasmania, there were some who were really condescending and who would say that the solution to the problem that we had was for us to go to Sydney and Melbourne. That was exactly what the people who were against changing the law in Tasmania would say. Oh, problem solved, you go to Sydney or Melbourne.
That's such a historical thing in Tasmania, though, isn't it? Just go elsewhere.
Yeah, but it was reinforced by people interstate. And both of those things were equally onerous, those ideas, and equally bad, okay? And we rebelled against each of them equally. In Tasmania, we were saying, we're proud to be queer and we're not going to be forced out. To those people in Sydney and Melbourne who were saying, oh, just come over here, so it's better, we were saying, no, we're proud of Tasmania and we're not going to be forced out. Or we're not going to be pulled by you. No, it was very much a local Tasmanian movement that took inspiration from the movements that were here. Now, like I said, there was a lot of support for our movement in Sydney and Melbourne and other places, but there was also a lot of support in Tasmania. And we had faith that Tasmanians would respond to our call for justice, which eventually they did. But no, this was about creating a new identity. I mean, for some people, it was about changing the law. And yeah, it was about changing the law. But it was more fundamentally about creating a new identity, one that of a gay Tasmanian, right? Which up until then had been something which many people, those, social conservatives in Tasmania, plus people in Sydney and Melbourne who thought that the future was living in a gay ghetto, both of those groups did not comprehend the idea of a gay Tasmanian. It seemed bizarre to them, but we knew the power of that new identity and we weren't going to shy away from the need for it. One of our slogans, thought up a little bit tongue-in-cheek to start with, but immensely popular in the end, was we're here, we're queer, and we're not going to the mainland. And that message was to those in Tasmania who wanted us to go. There was a member of the upper house who actually put forward a bill to have the government pay for one-way tickets for us to the mainland. Others who said we should be tracked down by the police and taken to an island somewhere, which was ironic given we're on one. But it was also a slogan, we're here, we're queer, and we're not going to the mainland, that was aimed at those people in Sydney and Melbourne who thought that living in a ghetto was the answer to gay oppression, to living on Oxford Street. Living on Oxford Street or living in Paran is the answer, and it's not the answer.
I don't think it's the answer to anything, is it? Ghettoisation is always a mistake.
Sometimes it's inevitable and sometimes it's necessary in order to protect yourself. And if you live in a very hostile environment, a very hostile society, it can be necessary to actually gather with others who are the same. But that's not how we felt in Tasmania in the late 1980s. It was impossible to imagine being free to be who we were, to be gay and Tasmanian living in Sydney or Melbourne. The first time we were in, we had a contingent in the Mardi Gras in 1994. I remember we were marching up up Oxford Street. And there was a really loud cheer because the people knew of the struggle we were having. And that was great. But I remember seeing those people leaning over the barricades with tears streaming down their cheeks and calling out, "Oh, I had to leave Tasmania 20 years ago and I've never been able to go back." Me and the people I worked with are determined not to be turned into sexual refugees. By those who wanted to escape Tasmania, and by those who thought that we should just go and live in Oxford Street.
It's funny you say that, because that was actually the year that I joined the AIDS Council of New South Wales, and I was in the Mardi Gras that year, and I remember the Tasmanian float. So there you go. I just remember thinking how awful it was that we still had this place where it was illegal to be yourself, and how appalling that was. But I just wanted to ask you about something you brought up earlier with the parallel with Aboriginal people in Tasmania, and the fact that Aboriginal people were basically told the same thing, that they would have to go somewhere else to be Aboriginal, otherwise they couldn't live in their own land.
They were told they didn't exist.
They were told they didn't exist, exactly. And I know, as I discussed with you before, I worked on Cape Barren Island for a few years, and that was a massive thing in that community, the fact that they'd been told that they didn't actually exist in Tasmania anymore. And even people that I spoke to when I was working on Cape Barren Island were like, "But there are no Aboriginal people in Tasmania. What are you talking about? We were taught this at school."
Yeah, it was similar because, as you said, that Aboriginal Tasmanians were told, if you want to be a proper Aboriginal, you need to go and live on the mainland because there aren't any in Tasmania.
Exactly.
And I can remember at the time in the late 80s and early 90s being on panels with Aboriginal people and talking about coming out. Their coming out as Indigenous was so similar to the way that LGBTIQA plus people have to come out. There were a lot of similarities, and we gained a lot of inspiration from the Aboriginal movement in Tasmania, from the way that it's so bravely and successfully challenged the idea of what it meant to be Tasmanian.
Absolutely.
They said, "We're not all white, okay? Just as we said, we're not all straight," in a tight-knit island society that has ramifications. And, of course, it had ramifications for us. Not long after I came out, we set up a group to try and get the law changed, and we set up a store at Salamanca Market. This was at the end of 1988. And the Hobart City Council banned the store. I said, quote, "We don't want any homosexuals in our family market." And when we said that's discrimination, they brought the police in. And 130 arrests were made over 7 consecutive Saturday mornings in what still remains the biggest act of gay rights civil disobedience in Australian history, bigger than the Mardi Gras.
I had no idea that that had happened. So, yeah, wow. Yeah.
It was a big coming out for our community, because many Tasmanians didn't think there were any gay people here. And it was our community showing that we weren't going to be trodden on. The Hobart City Council thought that by banning us, bringing in the police, it could intimidate us. Being silly queers, we'd just go away. But we didn't. We said, no, that's discrimination. And again, emboldened by those other movements I talked about, we knew that it was possible for us to change Tasmania for the better, and we wouldn't be able to do that unless we stood up to this discrimination, which we did. And it was really intimidating. It was really difficult. 130 people arrested, lines of police vans, television cameras from all over the nation, hundreds of people protesting. But eventually we won the right to have that store. And, of course, that was just the beginning of almost a decade of struggle for decriminalisation. Not long after that, there was a new government elected, the Field Labor government, with Green support. They committed to decriminalisation. There were anti-gay rallies held across Tasmania, the first and only such things ever in Australia, where hundreds of people would gather in a community hall and be whipped up into the most intense hatred by these speakers, who were usually politically motivated. But the hate, well, it was awful. And we would hire buses in Hobart, and we'd travel to Launceston, pick people up, come to the northwest coast when these rallies were in Ulverston or Burnie, which they too often were. And we'd have peaceful vigils outside. You know, people would walk in and spit on us, and it was a difficult time. And the bill for decriminalisation went through the lower house because of the Field government, Labor government, but then was knocked off in the upper house. Very angry.
Yeah.
By members who ripped the bill up and threw it in the bin, and, symbolically, or declared, like I said before, that the police should track us down and wipe us out. And that's when we decided that it was going to be a while before the Tasmanian Parliament was ready for this, and we took our case to the UN, the first case from Australia to go to the UN Human Rights Committee, and the first anywhere in the world about sexual orientation discrimination. We won that case 2.5 years later. The federal government passed a bill to render the Tasmanian laws inoperative. It didn't do the whole job because the laws were still not invalid, so we took a case to the High Court. When that looked like it was going to succeed, the Tasmanian government finally realised the game was up. And the legislation was passed on the 1st of May 1997. People listening to this will remember some of those events. They will remember the UN decision and federal government getting involved in the High Court. But what people are less aware of is that there was another level entirely to this campaign in the 1990s. And that was us going out and speaking to whomever would listen across Tasmania, service clubs and sporting clubs and school groups and party branches and union branches, talk to whomever would listen about why the laws needed to change. And we talked about privacy and equality and all of those things, but most of all, we talked about what it meant to be Tasmanian. Again, it was a very Tasmanian struggle. We were struggling not only to repeal a law, not only to create a new identity, but to redefine what it meant to be Tasmanian. So when the law did change in 1997, to us, it was more than just a law changing, it was a society change. And I think it's no coincidence that after the law changed, very soon after the law changed, to use a Tasmanian metaphor, it was as if a dam burst and out flowed all of this legislation. The best anti-discrimination laws in Australia are still the best. Best relationship laws, best laws recognising family relationships, inclusive of LGBTIQA+ people and others, best gender recognition laws, best education policies. We went in a very short time from worst to best. Tasmanian support for decriminalisation was 15% below the national average when we were getting arrested at Salamanca Market. But as people might remember, when the nation voted on marriage equality in 2017, Tasmania returned a yes vote that was the highest amongst the states after Victoria. So we've gone from the worst to best on laws and from the worst to near the best on attitude. That's a truly remarkable transformation that all Tasmanians should be proud of.
So touching on that too, because obviously this has been an ongoing struggle. It started with the decriminalisation, but obviously you were very active in the equal marriage debate as well. So tell me a little bit about how that sort of flowed into the next part of that process.
I sort of became involved in advocacy for marriage equality in 2003. So it's 6 years after the decriminalisation of homosexuality in Tasmania, and many of the major subsequent reforms that I just mentioned, like our Anti-Discrimination Act and Relationships Act, had been passed. But there was still a huge hole in any claim that we'd making. If you looked at, whether LGBTIQA+ people were equal, you could say, well, we're not criminals anymore and our relationships are recognised as de factos. But there's this big gap there, and that gap is marriage.
Yeah.
If LGBTIQA+ people, if our relationships are equally loving, equally committed and equally valuable, then why can't we marry? And for me, it was a bit like the issue of decriminalisation. It was about the prejudice that was underneath it. It wasn't just for me about walking down the aisle, as important as that is for many people. It was about trying to remove a prohibition which prejudice was hiding behind, and which it was launching attacks on us all the time from behind. So it was like this little bastion that prejudice had in the law, and it was constantly launching attacks against us, and it was constantly undermining our claim on dignity and equality. When the law says you can't marry, then it's effectively saying you're not fully an adult, that you can't make these kinds of decisions for yourself. It says you're not really fully human. So it was at that level that marriage equality was important to me. To me, it was an absolutely essential civil rights claim. In the same way, and I use that term deliberately, in the same way that being an interracial marriage was a really important civil rights claim in the civil rights movement in the US in the 1950s and 60s, and also in the Indigenous movement in Australia from the 1930s right through to the 1960s, because in a number of states, Queensland, WA, and in the Northern Territory, up until the 1960s, Aboriginal people couldn't decide for themselves who they married. It was all done by the protector of Aborigines. The protector would say, you have to marry this person, or you can't marry this person. And of course, women have endured that for centuries. And for me, it was the same thing. It was like, when you're told who you can't marry, you're being infantilized.
I have a bit of an odd take with this, Rodney, because as a cisgender straight woman, I've always been opposed to marriage per se. I've always had this idea that the basis for marriage was inequality to women and that women shouldn't engage in marriage in the first place. Having said that, I've always been of this position, well, I'm also against the military, But I support women being in the military if they want to. I'm against the priesthood because I'm an atheist, but I support women being in the priesthood. So it's always been a matter of individual rights that it doesn't matter if other people don't agree with it. It should still be your right to do it. So, you know, that's sort of my position with marriage. At the same time, it interests me that I've asked a lot of people in situations why they got married to their partner. And very often it was not a matter of romantic ideal of marriage. It was actually purely for legal reasons. So wanting to make sure that their partner had was contacted if they went into hospital, or that their partner had legal rights to their estate, or that recognized as their partner in law. Would you say that was also a big part of the equal marriage debate as well?
LGBTIQA plus people want to get married for the same reasons that everyone wants to get married, whatever they may be. Like you said, some people get married from notions of romance and lifelong union. Some people get married because they see it as a religious obligation. Some people get married because they feel like that's a solid foundation to raise kids. Some people get married because it guarantees them certain spousal rights and responsibilities, like the next of kin. And LGBTIQA plus people aren't any different to anyone else. That we get married for the same range of reasons. Legal certainty was one of the most important ones I found as I travelled around Australia and talked to people about why the issue mattered to me and why it mattered to them. So like I said, I started doing this in 2003, 2004. And of course, 2004 was when John Howard passed an amendment to the Marriage Act, explicitly banning the recognition of marriage, and that really put it on the table. And from that time, I was travelling around Australia, and it had only been in many states 1, 2, or 3 years since same-sex de facto relationships were recognised. At a federal level, that didn't happen for many years after. For many people, marriage was a way to cement their right in a very uncertain and patchy legal environment. So in Tasmania in 2003, same-sex partners were recognised as what we call significant partners, which is like de factos. But still, many people in the government and in various bodies weren't recognising that. In hospitals, people still weren't being recognised as partners for the purposes of medical decision-making or whatever it might be. In other states, that reform hadn't even happened. So as one, I wrote a couple of books about marriage equality, and as one person I interviewed said, whenever they moved interstate, they had to Google what their rights were.
That was an interesting thing because, again, coming from New South Wales, and I worked in the hospital system in New South Wales, it was just a given that the partner had the same rights as anybody else, irrespective of the nature of their relationship, whether they were married or de facto, gay or straight, whatever it happened to be. If they were the recognised partner of that person, then they had...
Maybe in some New South Wales hospitals there was respect for same-sex partners, but not in others. I know of examples in New South Wales where same-sex partners were turned away from hospitals and are not allowed to make medical decisions about their partners and allowed to see their partners. And that was a problem right across Australia. So legal certainty was certainly a major impetus for marriage equality for many people when the recognition of our relationships was such a patchwork and so unreliable. Issues like legal certainty were important for me, as they were for many other people. The fundamental issue for me was the recognition of our equal humanity and dignity and equality. And like I said before, prejudice, so much prejudice and so many stereotypes found refuge behind that prohibition on same-sex marriage. All the old stereotypes about gay relationships being short-lived and unstable and entirely sexual, all of the old nonsense about, you know, if you're gay, you'll be alone, you'll die alone. Yeah, all of this. That was becoming less so in the early 2000s in Australia, but those prejudices were still there. And the only way to get rid of them was to get rid of this old law that said LGBTIQA plus people don't really love and they can't really commit, which is what that law said.
And as I said to you before, I sort of grew up in this atmosphere. My mum was a painter. She went to East Sydney Art College. I grew up in, I guess, gay society. Half my mum's friends were gay or lesbian. I went to school with kids who were gay and lesbian. I don't know if you've ever heard of the 2010, the youth refuge in Glebe.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1991 or two, Our school was one of the first schools to admit mature age students to do their HSC who dropped out. And 2010 was up straight from my school in Glebe. So we had a cohort of about 7 or 8 kids from 2010 who decided that they wanted to go back and do their HSC. And they turned up at my school in year 11. And it was a bit of a wake-up call for both the teachers and the other students. But they became my dearest friends. It was always a really odd thing to me that people would be against people just because of their orientation. So I guess I came from it as a different perspective because I hadn't been brought up in prejudice. I'd been brought up in openness and acceptance, and I just was astonished that anyone could think any differently.
I grew up in a place and time where there was only one publicly out gay person. That was Bob Brown. I knew no other gay people. All gay things happened in Sydney. And the prejudice was very strong. It's just that we were soaked in anti-queer prejudice in Tasmania. That went back to colonial times, of course, and particularly strong in Tasmania because there had been same-sex relationships amongst the convicts and the officials had responded very violently against those. The anti-transportation movement, which was based in Tasmania, its main rhetorical tool against convict transportation was that convictism leads to unnatural vice. And as Robert Hughes has said, that Australian identity grew out of the anti-transportation movement, and the anti-transportation movement embedded homophobia at the core of Australian identity, and particularly Tasmanian identity. We were struggling against a lot. It's no surprise to me, given all that, that there were anti-gay rallies and that there were arrests of people just because they set up a card table on a public market, that there were laws passed against same-sex marriage and that there were, you know, it took way too long to have those laws changed. It's no surprise to me, given Australian history.
One of my most poignant memories, I guess, was when I was about 8 or 9 years old and my mother and I had been invited to the birthday party of a friend of hers that she was at university doing arts, and it was his 30th birthday, I believe. And we arrived at the birthday party and there was a note pinned to the door saying that the birthday party had been cancelled. And this young man had thrown himself in front of a train because he was gay and he didn't know how to deal with it, and he'd just been diagnosed with HIV. So that was something, as an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old, that just completely took me aback. And I think that's probably why I was always so very ready to come forward and defend my friends, whether or not they needed it sometimes. Why I was always very querying as of how anyone could be so inhumane.
Yeah, it is hard when you stand back and look at it. It is hard to understand the depth of cruelty involved. But it's
so. Do you feel that that has definitely changed in Tasmania and across Australia?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we only have to look at the opinion polls to see that it has. I see the effect of change every day in the way that people respond to same-sex partnerships in Tasmania and nationally. Marriage equality did do what I hoped it would do. And that is, it was a death knell to all of those old stereotypes. Now, that's not to say there isn't still prejudice and discrimination, because there is, against gay, lesbian, bisexual people, same-sex attracted people.
Yeah.
And of course, the other bigger issue is that even though prejudice, or actually because prejudice against same-sex attracted people is declining precipitously, there's been an upsurge in prejudice against trans people.
Yep. That was actually something I did want to talk to you about too, with what's been going on recently with the Catherine Deves stuff in the federal election and all that sort of thing. What's your opinion about that?
Marriage equality has had, like I said, marriage equality has had a really positive impact here and across all of those countries where it's been enacted. But starting in about 2015, 2016, with the decision of the US Supreme Court to recognise marriage equality across the whole of the US, a backlash arose to marriage equality. And that backlash came to Australia in about 2016. It found a huge platform during the postal survey in 2017, and we haven't been able to get rid of it since. And that backlash takes three forms. A backlash to existing discrimination protections, particularly for LGBTIQA plus people, but not only us, in the name of religious freedom. So this idea that religious freedom is somehow threatened by discrimination laws, even if those laws have been around, as in the case of Australia, for 20 years, 30 or 40 years. This was the basis for the Morrison government's religious discrimination bill. It sought not to reduce levels of discrimination against people of faith, which is fine, you know, that's something that discrimination law should do, What it sought to do was allow more discrimination in the name of. And we're all breathing a sigh of relief that that bill's gone now, with the Prime Minister who sponsored it so vehemently. But as a Tasmanian in particular, that bill was absolutely horrific because it would have rolled back our discrimination law more than any other states, because ours is as better than any other states. It really was very specifically targeted at Tasmania. That bill was saying to Tasmanians, we know that you've made progress in the last 20 years and we're going to roll that back.
I'd never even considered that it was actually targeted at Tasmania. I just thought of it as a general type of thing. But, yeah, I can see where that's coming from.
Well, it was general, of course. It had impacts, negative impacts for people across the country, not only LGBTIQA plus people, but also people with disability, women, particularly women accessing healthcare, people in minority faiths, ethnic communities, even Indigenous communities. Anyone who could fall foul of traditional religious dogma would be negatively impacted by that bill because it allowed traditional religious dogma to override discrimination protections. But the state where those discrimination protections would have been rolled back the most was Tasmania. And in fact, Tasmania was the state, the only state that was specifically mentioned in that in terms of weakening discrimination protection. So it was bad for everyone, particularly Tasmanians. Now, that bill has gone. I fear that, though, that we'll continue to see this religious freedom argument made against discrimination protections for quite a while to come. The second part of this backlash, which arose in the United States, was a backlash to LGBTIQA plus inclusive schools. The biggest example of this in Australia was the backlash to the Safe Schools Program, which was funded by the Abbott government. But then they decided that, oh, no, we can't have any inclusion in schools, so they attacked. That's been going on for years in the US, and we're seeing the latest example of that in the US with the governor of Florida, Rob DeSantis, and his Don't Say Gay bills. And I fear that, because it's been a few years since Safe Schools, that the now federal opposition may well be planning to have another go at inclusive schools. So watch out for that. The third part of this backlash, of course, as we all know, is a backlash against trans inclusion and trans human rights. In the US, it began as this push to stop trans women going into women's bathrooms, bathroom bills. Then it spread out into sport, stopping trans women competing against other women in sport, cis women in sport, and then services in general, and it just gets bigger and bigger. The tide of this hate from the US keeps coming here. We saw it in Catherine Deaves, her candidature in Warringah, which seemed to be based almost entirely on her desire to exclude trans women from everything. And we've seen it in Senator Claire Chandler, the Liberal senator from Tasmania, who put up a bill to exclude trans women from women's sport. It's a huge, hateful, moral panic, and the impact on trans people is devastating. And we all need to be as good allies to trans and gender diverse people as we can possibly be.
Absolutely. Look, and I agree with you. It's a moral panic that's really completely unfounded. If you have a listen to a couple of the podcasts we did, we've actually touched on those issues too. And I did talk a lot about the whole issue with inclusivity and the religious discrimination bill and how that would affect Tasmanian schools, particularly because of the way that we do colleges and how many of those are private and religiously funded. My concern was that really, Tasmanians don't have a lot of choice about where to send their children if they live in remote areas. And often the only choice that they have is to send them to a religious funded college to complete their education, and how that possibly would affect both the students being excluded from an education because of that, but also the teachers who didn't have a choice about where they could teach. If you live in a certain community, you've got a limited scope of where you can work if you're a teacher.
It's actually worse than that, because Tasmania was, until earlier this year, the only state to ban discrimination against LGBTIQ plus students and teachers in faith-based schools. Mm. And the federal religious discrimination bill specifically overrode that. It sought to override that protection. So for the first time in 20 years, teachers or trans students would be able to be discriminated against legally. Now, they already face discrimination, but it's not legal. This would have legitimized it. The federal bill would also have overridden the law in Tasmania against bullying that's in the Anti-Discrimination Act, which prohibits intimidating and harassing behaviour on the grounds, on a range of different grounds. It would have allowed that kind of behaviour if it was in the name of religion. Tasmania is in the state to have that law. So, again, we would have been targeted by that. That religious discrimination bill was a nightmare. And I want to say thank you to those federal politicians from Tasmania who stood up to that bill and who said that they couldn't support it across the board.
They're all, including Bridget Archer, I noted, because that was an important thing in one of our former podcasts where we talked about crossed the floor.
Yeah, well, it was very brave of her to do that, and I think she encouraged others to do that. I think she really saved our bacon.
I agree.
No, I didn't. That wasn't meant to be a pun about the fact that the Anti-Discrimination Act was passed by Jim Bacon, but she really does need to be commended for bravely standing up for Tasmania in that instance against her own party leadership. And the current Premier, Jeremy Rockliffe, also spoke out against the religious discrimination. Previous Premier, Peter Gutman, did the same. And, of course, there were Labor members and independents, Jackie Lambie, Andrew Wilkie, all these people said this is bad for Tasmania. And how ironic that was, given that in the 1990s, like I said earlier, it was the federal government that was stepping in to override an old homophobic Tasmanian law. And now, almost 20 years later, almost 30 years later, we have the federal government, a Liberal federal government, trying to step in to reverse Tasmania's gains on inclusion and equality. It was astonishing. It speaks volumes to how far Tasmania's come since the 90s.
It is quite ironic too that we've come so far against such a background. I mean, and yourself and Bob Brown and probably famous Tasmanians like Hannah Gadsby have probably contributed to a lot of that as well.
Yes, and also a lot of Tasmanians who aren't famous.
True. Very true, yeah.
And
some of whom I would consider my dear friends.
Yes, and who stood up when they needed to and put Tasmania at the forefront. We were talking about the marriage debate before. We tend to forget that Tasmania was, so this was obviously after the decriminalisation, and Tasmania had begun to go from worst to best. Tasmania was the first state to recognise overseas same-sex marriages, first Australian state to have a same-sex marriage bill put forward. We had a whole lot of firsts in that debate because we were moving ahead. When we all voted during the Marriage Equality Postal Survey in 2017, the Tasmanian yes vote was higher than any other state except Victoria.
Actually, let's go back to that a little bit, because a friend of mine actually asked me specifically to mention to you about how you actually left the push for it when they brought in the plebiscite for the reasons of how harmful that was to a lot of people's mental health, that we actually had to have a plebiscite when it should have just been an act of parliament. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. A plebiscite was an unequal process. Why only does this law require a plebiscite and not others? And also a damaging and destructive process, because it meant it was a platform for a whole lot of hate. And I'd seen the impact of that hateful anti-gay rallies and all of the hatred in the 90s in Tasmania. I knew of young men who killed themselves. And so I decided to put my energy into stopping that plebiscite because I didn't want that to happen again. And that meant leaving Australian marriage equality. I founded Australian Marriage Equality in 2004 when John Howard was moving to amend the Marriage Act and had been the national director for many years. But Australian Marriage Equality had to work with the government on trying to get, I guess, the best terms for a plebiscite, or trying to work out, you know, how much money each side would get, all that kind of stuff. And that made it harder for it to be out there campaigning against one. So I joined forces with other, you know, PFLAG, Rainbow Families, other groups that were really worried about the impact of a plebiscite on vulnerable LGBTIQA+ people and our children. And we lobbied the then Labor opposition under Bill Short and everyone else, and it was blocked in the Senate. So Malcolm Turnbull, the plebiscite had originally been Tony Abbott's idea, but then, of course, he got knocked off by Malcolm Turnbull. Malcolm Turnbull kept that policy going, which was disappointing. So then we went to the Senate and the Labor Party and to block it in the Senate. And like I said, it was blocked at the end of 2016. And we thought that was it. You know, we won't have to have this awful plebiscite. And we hoped that the Liberals would go back to plan A, which was to have a conscience vote. That's what they should have done. But they didn't. Instead, Peter Dutton came up with the idea of the Bureau of Statistics conducting a postal survey. And the difference was that a postal survey didn't need Parliament's approval. A plebiscite, as proposed by Malcolm Turnbull, did. And when the Senate said no, then that was the end of that. But a postal survey was something the government could do of its own accord. We challenged that in the High Court, but the High Court agreed that the government did have the power to do it, and off the government went in 2017. But it was hard for me to leave Australian marriage equality. It was very hard because marriage equality was such an important issue to me. When the postal survey did happen, I did all I could to try and boost the yes vote in Tasmania. So I became my focus was here.
So ultimately, obviously, it was successful. Yay. A couple of dear friends of mine tied the knot last weekend after having been together for, I think, about 25 or 30 years. So good for them. And obviously there's been lots and lots of marriages since then. And for some weird reason, Tasmania seems to have become the gay marriage place to be. So reflecting back on that, how do you feel about what happened subsequently?
Obviously, I'm very happy that people are able to get married. I've seen it bring a lot of happiness to many people. As you say, Tasmania seems to be gay marriage capital. I guess that's because it's such a beautiful place to get married, and also because people know that the attitudes and laws have changed. So I'm very proud of that. But what I'm most proud of is that there's less prejudice against same-sex attracted people than there used to be. And like I said earlier, I see that every day. More people feel able to come out. There's less hate speech. There's more recognition of the needs of gay, lesbian and bisexual people by government. So, yeah, that's all fantastic. And it was definitely a step forward, and I'm very proud of my involvement in it. But like I said, it has sparked a backlash. The fact that it sparked a backlash is probably evidence of what an important change it has been, because those who are fighting a rearguard action against marriage equality, they know that the world's changed and they want to try and turn back the clock. And they're doing that with the focus on the religious freedom and inclusion in schools and, of course, on trans people. Some of those people who are actually campaigning against trans inclusion are quite open about it. They say, well, we can't attack the gays and the lesbians anymore, so we're attacking these people because they're less well understood. There's more prejudice against them, and so they're more vulnerable. They're being attacked precisely because they're more vulnerable. That's what's behind. Claire Chandler would never have a bill before the parliament to exclude lesbians from sport because they've got an advantage or whatever nonsense. But yeah, it's easier to attack trans people, and that's why it's so important that each of us figures out the best way that we can stand up as allies of trans and gender diverse people, our friends, our family, and those that we don't even know, because they are really, it's really tough for them. Every time there's a stupid letter in the paper, respond, send in something saying, no, my trans friends are not a threat to other people. Trans women are not a threat to women's rights or women's sport or women's bathrooms. And it's there in the statistics. Trans women, you know, more likely than many other people, far more likely than the average to be attacked in a public place. And the prejudice and discrimination against trans people is through the roof. And the mental health impacts of that are through the roof. We know that from the studies. Yet somehow they're portrayed as the victimizer rather than the victims. You can see how the stereotypes that used to be used against gay and lesbian people are now used against trans people. Young trans people don't really know their own mind. It's just a phase. It's social contagion. They heard that it was trendy at school, so now they want to be trans too. As if joining being a member of a stigmatized minority is trendy.
I know. Yeah, I find that unbelievable too. It's like, oh, you know, you've chosen to be different. No, I'm just different, and you're just going to have to learn to deal with that. And the fact too is that I heard someone comment a little while ago about, oh, well, there just seems to be a plague of homosexuals and trans people. And I'm like, no, they were always around. They just didn't feel brave enough to make themselves known. And now it's a lot more accepting that they can actually be the person that they always were. You just didn't see it before. I totally understand where you're coming from. My point of view as far as trans people in sport is that everyone should actually be co-ed. We should all just be performing on the same field. Doesn't matter if you're male, female or trans, and competing according to our abilities, because there's lots of elite female athletes who compete at high levels who beat men on a regular basis. So I don't see why that should be any different for trans people.
With community sport, what we've found in Tasmania is that a lot of community sporting teams and associations, they're actually asking for more information about how to be trans inclusive. They don't want to know how to exclude trans people. They want to know how to include, because the whole rationale for these organisations is to increase the number of people who play sport. That's what they're there for. In terms of elite sport, I think the best response I heard recently was from Martine Delaney, who's a prominent trans advocate in Tasmania. She actually, as a soccer player, was involved in the Football Federation of Australia changing its policy, and then she worked with the AFL to change its policy. And what the AFL does at the elite level is that it's case by case. They look at the factors that will make a difference in terms of athletic ability in relation to that sport, red blood cell count and physical frame and lung capacity and, you know, the hormone levels and the impact of the hormone, all that kind of stuff. And she thinks that that, you know, while it's not perfect, is probably the best way to go at an elite level. What is definitely not the best way to go is what the Swimming Federation has done, FINA, which is just ban trans women.
Yep.
Full stop. That makes no sense at all, because there's as much variation amongst trans women as there is amongst other women. And the FINA people have said the science is in. It's not in. There's still so much that we need to know that we don't know about the athletic ability, the athletic impacts of hormone treatment and all this kind of stuff. And there's this sense of threat, which is so exaggerated. In all the articles about excluding trans women from sport, you know, there'll be one or two people who are mentioned. Leah Thomas, I think, was in the swimming context, an American trans woman who won one college final. And all of a sudden, it's like the sky's falling in. One college championship, one race, that was it that they won. It's the same with the bathrooms and all the rest. It's just this big panic that has no basis in reality and turns people who really are vulnerable into fake aggressors. It's like the Middle Ages. All of a sudden, the Jews are taking our children again.
This has always been my point too, is it's like we shouldn't exclude people. We should only include everybody. And the mere fact that we have separate bathrooms for sex has always bewildered me. It's like, well, going to a cubicle, we share bathrooms at home. What difference does it make?
Mm-hmm.
And I've always found it very curious the way that, you know, it's like, well, you have to go into that box and I'll go into this box, and then we need a separate box for everybody else that doesn't fit in those two boxes. Why don't we just all sit in the same box and just, you know, be friends and not worry about the differences, worry about the similarities instead, and the fact that we're all human and that we should just get along.
That reminds me of when Scott Morrison said something against the toilets at Parliament House becoming gender neutral, and a journalist asked him, oh, which toilet do you use at home, the male or the female?
Exactly right. That's the thing. Someone said to me, well, what about the disabled toilets? They're neither male nor female. They're just for disabled people. So why don't we have separate male and female disabled toilets?
The Devonport City Council just got a grant from the Tasmanian Liberal government to make its toilets gender neutral. If the Devonport City Council can deal with gender-neutral toilets, everyone can. I mean,
absolutely.
What's the issue? The issue is stirring up prejudice for political gain, pandering to bigotry so you'll get a few more votes. That's the issue. That's what it's about.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
It's just like the Middle Ages where the local prince said, go and get the Jews, they ate your children, and stop looking at the fact that I'm a terrible leader.
Yeah, it's distraction, isn't it? Distraction. And so segueing into that, because I'm conscious that we've been at this for an hour and a half already, can you talk a little bit about the conversion practice work that you're doing at the moment against conversion practices? Because I've heard about this happening overseas, obviously in America and places like this, but I'm not really familiar about what's been happening locally.
Well, conversion practices, just to be clear, that's when someone pathologizes LGBTIQA plus people, says that we're somehow broken or flawed, and then goes on to propose a cure for that pathology, which could be coursework or exorcisms or prayer groups or whatever. We're in a good position to know exactly what's happening, because at the end of last year, in the beginning of this year, two key studies came out. One of them was from The Trobe University does a regular big national survey of LGBTIQA plus youth, and for the first time it included a question about conversion practices. And what it found was that 1 in 20 of those young people have been through formal conversion practices in the last couple of years. So it's 5%. And that those young people are 3 to 4 times more likely to have PTSD and to have attempted suicide. More likely than other LGBTIQA plus youth who already have very elevated levels of mental distress. So that's pretty distressing situation. Then this year, the Tasmanian government did a survey of the LGBTIQ community here in Tasmania, the largest ever done. It put some conversion questions in, same results, exactly the same. So we know that of all, you know, if you know 20 LGBTIQA plus people, more than likely, statistically, one of them is going to have been through conversion practices.
On the background of that, obviously that's more likely to happen with people who are also religiously aligned or come from a religious background.
It has happened in the past and does still happen in health contexts as well. I work with 3 Tasmanian conversion survivors. 2 of them went through conversion practices in a religious setting, one of them in a health setting as a lesbian. Quite a few young trans people also experience conversion practices in health settings. But yeah, it would be fair to say that the majority are in religious settings. But when we say religious settings, we need to qualify that because conversion practices almost always, even if they happen in religious settings, there's false and misleading pseudo-psychological claims. It's as if the religious minister takes off the religious robes and puts on medical robes and pretends to be a therapist offering pretend therapy. And in fact, during the inquiry into this issue by the Tasmanian Law Reform Institute, a church minister in Launceston actually said that. He said, "I think of myself as a therapist." And that's exactly the problem, because he's not. He's not qualified to be a therapist. And the conversion ideology that he's using is not in any way scientific. It's just nonsense. It's just a pseudo-scientific nonsense. All this stuff, all this discredited stuff about, you know, boys being gay because they weren't close enough to their fathers, or the, you know, girls being lesbian because they had some trauma in their childhood. All this kind of stuff, which is completely discredited and no legitimate health profession holds anymore. That's the kind of pseudo-nonsense, or actual nonsense, pseudo-psychology, being foisted on people with the promise that they can somehow change.
And also the idea that they should change.
Yeah, so they're conditioned with shame that they should change, and then they're given this solution to that, which is that they can change. And that's where the problem really arises. When I've spoken to survivors, they go into this thinking, I'm same-sex attracted, or I'm trans, God hates me, I've got to change. They go into the program, they do the program earnestly, nothing changes. And then things get bad. Then it's their failure, their fault, and God hates them, their family hates them, their church hates them, completely isolated. That's when they're at their most vulnerable. And that's when this becomes so, so cruel. Now, of course, those who perpetrate conversion practices are saying, oh, we're doing it in the best interest of those involved because say they think they're saving souls or whatever. But the evidence is overwhelming. This, A, doesn't work, and B, causes immense psychological harm.
When someone's telling you that your very being is wrong and objectionable, I don't see how that wouldn't affect you in a negative way, and that you have to change to be accepted. Like, how? How do I change my essential being?
And some of the survivors talk about it becoming almost that they left when they realised that it was a kind of almost like a business, that we charged money for the courses they went to. And sometimes the money would turn up, just, you know, someone had donated it. But there are professional prayers, pray over you and exorcists and people who run these courses and sell their manuals. And it just all became, yeah, it looked like a business, a very shonky business. And it's based on false premises. It inflicts deep harm. It doesn't work. I don't understand why we haven't banned this already. Now, in 3 places we have in Australia, in Queensland, the ACT and Victoria, just last month in May, the Tasmanian Law Reform Institute issued a report saying that it should be banned in Tasmania, a very comprehensive report. And to his credit, our Premier, Jeremy Rockliffe, responded saying, yep, we're going to pass legislation. So that's great.
Awesome.
Good on him.
Awesome. Yeah. Yeah, look, I mean, it's another of those areas that's always bewildered me too, that, you know, why would you want to change someone who's not broken? But, you know, I have a friend who has been been through that as well, and went through that whole thing of being told that he was mentally unwell and that the only way he could get better was by going through that process. And it was incredibly damaging to him. But I mean, of course, historically, you know, it used to be on the DSM-4 as a mental illness. And of course, that's all been discredited and taken off the DSM-4. So it's, yeah, purely coming from a position of ignorance. I mean, it ties in a little bit to the whole argument of having chaplains in schools too, providing pastoral care to students, which I find very odd.
Yeah, it's hard to see many LGBTIQA plus kids accessing pastors or school chaplains for help because they don't know what kind of response they're going to get. Yes, schools should have proper counsellors and psychologists. If there are going to be pastors or chaplains, if that is going to continue to be a thing, they should be trained. They should be trained in how to deal with LGBTIQA plus kids. And if they don't like to be trained, if they don't want that training or not going to, you know, work by particular standards that everyone expects in schools, then they should be out of schools.
Absolutely. Well, they should be working in schools in the first place.
We know, again, from the studies, including the one I mentioned before from the Tribune, that young LGBTIQ plus kids are still having a hard time in schools. Things have improved, of course. Some schools have diversity groups or pride groups, more teacher training now than there used to be in LGBTIQ plus issues. There's more policy than there used to be, positive policy, but a lot of kids are still suffering, and we need to do everything we can to help those kids, not make things more difficult.
One of the things that concerned me too about the religious discrimination bill and removing teachers from schools, obviously that bought into that whole idea of only having teachers there who ascribe to their Christian values and who weren't admittedly homosexual, lesbian or trans, was this removal of positive role models from those LGBTQI kids' lives. So, you know, one of my most positive role models at my school was a very openly gay English teacher who was fantastic. You know, I thought he was the best thing since sliced bread. And he was unashamedly gay. And, you know, he was one of the main people that said to me, this is okay. This is just a person who is being himself. And no one should be ashamed of being themselves. So that's one of the things that's concerned me a lot with that religious discrimination bill, that those sorts of people won't allow to be themselves.
That was a problem with that bill, for sure. And I fear it may continue to be a problem even under this government. So the new Albanese Labor government has said that it will protect LGBTIQA plus kids in faith-based schools from discrimination, which is great, in those states that don't have that. Which is particularly now New South Wales, South Australia and WA. But it equivocates on the teacher issue. It should be really straightforward, just say protect the teachers as well, because like you say, the kids need role models. And these schools are funded by the taxpayer. Taxpayers expect them to come up to a certain standard. Taxpayers and parents who send their kids to those schools expect teachers to be selected on the basis of merit and competence, not piety or sexuality.
Absolutely.
So I don't understand. I mean, politically I understand, but in terms of principle, I don't understand why the federal government is still, or the new federal government is still a bit wobbly on this. My fear is it's going to send this issue off to an inquiry so that it doesn't have to deal with it until next term. But that means that, again, teachers in those states that don't have these protections at the state level will continue to be in jeopardy, and they're being sacked. We know they're being sacked, particularly since marriage equality, as part of the backlash that I mentioned before. We've seen an increase in teachers being sacked, gay and lesbian teachers, particularly if they get married, which is always bewildering to me, because you have religious conservatives saying people should get married. Marriage is the holy institution. It brings stability to relationships and to kids and to all the rest of it. But when a gay person gets married, no, that's the worst thing you can possibly do.
Mind you, 60 years ago, if a woman got married, she couldn't work anymore either. Because somehow that destabilised the family unit if mum was working.
One of the arguments I put forward for marriage equality was that marriage as an institution has evolved. It is evolving. So that partners are more equal now than they used to be. Not completely, but, male and female partners are more equal in the law than they used to be. And it's that precisely that evolution in marriage and greater equality between married partners that makes same-sex marriage conceivable. I mean, if we still live the 1940s and men had to earn a living and women had to look after the home, then two men getting married or two women getting married would have made less sense to people. It's like, but how can that happen? How does that work?
Who's going to do all the cooking and cleaning?
Yeah, exactly. And I know that the burden of housework is still more on women, but it's less inequitable than it used to be. And married partners have greater rights. In a world of no-fault divorce, it makes less and less sense to an equality between partners. It makes less and less sense to discriminate in marriage against same-sex partners.
So we now have parental leave as opposed to maternity leave or paternity leave.
Yeah, exactly.
Which I think is a massive gain.
Yes, exactly. So it was that evolution in the institution of marriage itself, I think, which made gay marriage and marriage equality more conceivable and supportable.
So quick question about that too. So my parents weren't married. And I managed to inherit both my parents' names. So I was always given a bit of discrimination when I was growing up because I was a bastard, I was told quite frequently. From that point of view, I sort of got a little bit of that too. But it's always been curious. It's always been a curious thing to me that now, of course, marriage isn't that popular amongst cisgender heterosexual people. It's gone out of fashion a little bit. We're not doing it as much, and there seems to be a lot more acceptance these days for children of de facto partnerships or single parents, whether or not they're male or female, without their parents having been married. It's almost like a non-event now. No one actually cares. How do you think that affects the society as a whole, taking into consideration the equal marriage debate? I mean, what happens when your equal marriage partners, same-sex marriage partners, decide to split ways and parent?
As marriage, as we move away from a time when marriage was exclusively associated, as you said, if you had a child, it had to be in wedlock, otherwise it was illegitimate. That changed in the 70s. The idea that women lost their rights when they got married and were subservient to their husbands. The idea that you had to have sex within marriage and that was the only legitimate form of sex. All these old ideas fade away, and as marriage just becomes another option, like living together as a de facto partner or being a single parent, as they all become, they're not yet, but as they become more equal options for people, choices for people, then the idea that you'd allow some same-sex partners some of those choices, but not others, it just didn't make any sense anymore.
Mm.
When marriage no longer had that, it was no longer sitting on a golden pedestal and that said, this is the only way to have sex, have kids, and to live, then it made no sense to exclude us. So, like I said, the evolution of marriage, I think, was critical to achieving marriage equality. as well as evolution in attitudes towards LGBTIQA plus people, which obviously was occurring at the same time in parallel as the evolution of marriage. And at one point, people, well, we know that point, it was in September, October 2017, people went, this doesn't make sense anymore. Why on earth would we stop gay people getting married? And they, and 64% of people in Tasmania at least voted yes.
And yay. I think that's a really good note to finish on. What do you reckon, Rodney?
Yeah. And again, thanks for having me on the podcast. I appreciate it. Appreciate a chance to talk about what to me and hopefully to others are really important issues.
Oh, look, they definitely are. And it's something we're definitely very, very positive about and very engaged in with this podcast as well. So we do talk a lot about these issues in a political context. If you have a listen to it, you'll notice that we often get sort of sidetracked a fair bit too, and launch into diatribes against various things that we say is incredibly unfair. Hopefully you'll get a chance to listen to some of them because they can be quite funny. But yeah, love to have you on again if you're interested too. So I don't know what do you want to do? Are you happy to forward me the reporting on your side of things?
Yeah, I'll do that straight away so I don't forget.
Cool. Awesome. So what I'll do is I'll have a chat to Damien who does the podcast. We'll probably take some splices from this talk, but I wouldn't be surprised if he wants to do a standalone as well. Would you be all right with that?
Sure.
Because, yeah, we have talked for, 2 hours almost, and I think it was pretty cool. I enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was great. Thank you. I'm sorry that it was a bit difficult to arrange.
That's okay. And I'm glad your hearing aids seem to be doing you justice there.
Yeah, they've all recharged now.
Oh, cool. My sister-in-law, she's just having to get hearing aids as well. I think she's about the same age as you, so I'll have to let her know. It's a bit of an interesting process. Like, they're pretty expensive these days, I hear, too.
$2,000 each.
Wow. Okay.
Yep. There should definitely be a Medicare rebate for these ones.
Oh yeah, I agree with you there. Mind you, there's a lot of things that should be Medicare rebates, including dental.
This is absolutely what we should do.
Dental
should be there already. They do dental in other countries. It's just ridiculous that we don't.
Well, and look, you know, as a nurse, I've been practicing for 24 years and I've worked a lot in drug and alcohol and transplant and various other things. And so many health conditions come from bad dental health. So it's like it actually makes sense in the broader healthcare scheme to have dental included in that, because you're actually going to cut down on people having things like rheumatic heart disease later on.
Yeah. Well, I wish our decision makers could see the logic in that. All they care about is expenses now. They don't seem to realise the benefits in the long term.
No. Well, hopefully when I finish my master's degree, I'm going to hopefully work in health policy and, you know, you never know, I might be the next advisor to the Minister for Health. So we'll see. I have to learn a bit more before then, but we'll get there. Drug and alcohol, second time round, has been very illuminating because I worked in the area in Sydney 18 years ago. So now I'm working again in Tasmania, and it's amazing how much things have changed but how much it's stayed the same.
I can imagine.
So it hasn't, you know, it's getting there though. Harm minimisation, that's all I can say. We just keep going.
Yes.
Yep. Thank you so much, Rodney. Look, next time you're in Hobart, definitely look me up. We'll try and catch up for a coffee or something like that.
Yeah, okay.
And I'll send you all the stuff when the podcast comes out. I have no idea how long it's going to take for Damien to put it all together, do his magic, but I'll let you know.
Sure. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Have a great night.
You too. Bye.
See you.
In history's page, let every stage advance a strength.